I'm Laurie.
Hey, I'm Phil.
And it is episode number 9 of the Super Bailey Bros in Movieland podcast.
Hooray!
And we've got a really good show coming up for you. Phil and I went to see Joy today, Jennifer Lawrence's and David O. Russell's latest film. Looking forward to talking about that one?
Yeah, I am looking forward to talking about it. I think there's a lot going on there.
Like always, we'll do a short spoiler-free thing up front, and then we'll talk about it with all the gloves off, and we can talk about the resolution of the film and that sort of stuff towards the end of the podcast.
Yep, and I wonder how many times people have suggested films to you, Laurie.
Quite frequently, yeah.
Quite frequently. I found, especially since we started this podcast, lots of people have been suggesting movies to me.
That's true. They all want us to take a look at their favourites, don't
exactly.
they?
Exactly, and it's quite difficult to gauge whether or not you should listen to their suggestions or not. So I think I've come up with a cunning system to work out whether or not I should pay attention.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, so that's something we're going to be talking about a bit later on.
A little Phil Bailey test.
A litmus test.
I can't think of a pun quick enough. A filmus test.
That's rubbish.
It is rubbish. Let's skip past that one. And you know, it's a new year, and with a new year brings a new Super Bailey Bros film.
New Super Bailey Bros.
That's right.
Movieland.
Look, it's the time to look ahead to the future, and the Super Bailey Bros are doing that. We see a long future ahead.
Yeah.
A very slim and very healthy future, Phil. So there's a couple of things we're going to do. We're going to try and cut down the overall length of our podcast. We think we can be even funnier and better and more interesting in less words. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think we're resolving to be better.
As in a New Year's resolution. It's very clever. And one of the things that's coming in is a brand new feature.
Yep, so what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the movies we've been watching this week, what we've been watching this week. We're going to give a little taster of what we thought so that we can talk about those movies which have maybe aren't the newest releases.
Or new releases that we just don't want to be, you know, our big film of the week. So Joy is the big film this week, but hey, I saw Daddy's Home in the cinema as well in Northern Ireland, so I'll tell you about that.
Exciting.
Oh, hooray. Something else that I thought, well, I don't really know how to categorise this one. So something I've noticed is in films, in quite recent films, there's a bit of a trend for actors to be eating while they're delivering dialogue. And you and I, Phil, grew up in a home where eating at the table, that's fine. It's speaking with food in your mouth, you know, was not considered very polite. Why do directors do it? We'll look into that one. What an episode it's shaping up to be, and we've got a lovely, delicious email to digest first.
Have we?
Yes, we do. Guess who it is?
Who is it?
Well, guess. I said guess.
Is it Barack Obama?
It's not Barack Obama, though I'm sure he's a big fan. Take another guess.
Is it Shia LaBeouf?
Not Shia LaBeouf. You can see you're not going to get this, Phil. It is David Samuel.
Of course, David Samuel.
Who we very much missed in our Star Wars episode as well as last week's as well. He's been curiously absent. But he says, ho, 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 Bailey bro, sorry to miss the last podcast entirely. He got a bit choppy for him over Christmas and all. He was in a bit of a flap.
It's a tough time, isn't it? You know, like lots going on, family. And
he says, going back to your watching films with friends segment last week, he's got a couple of stories of his own there, and one in particular stands out for him. He says, a close friend of mine's birthday had a group of people round to celebrate, and a lack of games meant we went for the movie box instead and settled on Airplane, the classic Airplane.
Oh, yeah, Airplane, Leslie Nelson. Great fun.
You know something's wrong when by the time the plane's off the ground, there's not even a little laugh.
Not one.
Not this escape from the lips of the people there.
Surely not.
They switched the film. It was that
no.
bad.
No.
So that is a terrible one.
That's brutal.
I myself had a similar experience with Airplane. I think there's a generation thing going on there.
You have to kind of get it, don't you, a bit, right from the get-go.
You've got to be up for it. Like, if you're waiting for it to impress you, it won't, because it's not trying to impress you, I don't think.
Yeah, that's making me cringe. Poor David Samuel.
It's very painful. Well, it's a friend of his, of course, there, Phil. Well, thanks very much for the email, David, and he sent a picture too.
Thanks for the picture, David. That's great.
Thanks for the picture, David.
We've seen Joy today.
Joy to the world.
That was going to be my line.
We saw the film.
Today, oh, we dear. Saw the film.
That we did. Jennifer Lawrence and David Russell wowed us in the cinema, or did they wow us, Phil?
Well, you know, I felt really weird watching this movie.
Why?
I didn't know. I don't think the movie makers knew what film they were making.
Interesting comment. We just want to say no spoilers in this little thing. We're going to keep it slim. We'll give you our thoughts and our first impressions, and feel free to listen to this today and make up your own minds whether to go see it. What's it about?
It's sort of based on a true story. It's about a lady called Joy and her family. She's got a rough home life.
Domineering father and all that sort of stuff.
She's got a half-sister who's sort of always undermining her. It's kind of following her trials and failures and successes as she tries to pursue an invention of hers. It's all quite bleak, really, for Joy, isn't it?
I know, and, you know, that really stayed with me throughout the whole film. I think if there's one thing that it did well, it's that it made me think, you know, this really feels quite hopeless. It's quite miserable. Not only is she meeting failure quite often, but her own family appear to be people who aren't really there for her, but people who are also trying to bring her down and make her feel less than she is.
It's messy. I think the messiness is right in the face of the audience, right from the beginning. Everyone's basically looking to her to fix their lives. And she gets no appreciation for it at all.
We already know you're a bit mixed about this one. So what was good, Phil?
I think there's real quality to the cast. I think Jennifer Lawrence, again, more and more each time I see her, I think she's a quality actress.
Do you think she distinguished herself in this one? Because it's quite hard for her, The Mockingjay having only recently been released.
But I felt she was a completely different character. She felt very different. The really amazing thing about Jennifer Lawrence is the fact that her age seems to shift with each role. She doesn't.
Do you think so?
She doesn't seem to be anchored by her actual physical age. She can play a lot sort of older, more mature role, and then also play a teenage girl running around in the woods with a bow. I think that's quite a unique ability for a young actress to have.
Yeah, definitely. I thought she was good too, especially towards the beginning of the film when she's in this environment where everyone expects a lot of her, but actually everyone's keeping her down, and she can't possibly keep up with everything that's going on around her. There were some really nice, subtle elements to her performance, just in the delivery of some of her lines, expressions, and her physical performance I thought was really strong. She just looked worn out.
Yeah.
I personally don't even think she was that great in the latter half of the film, but I would agree with you for the beginning.
That's interesting, because the latter half of the film is where I personally enjoyed it more, and I thought, oh, I can see what this movie should have been.
Sure. Well, let's stick with the other good stuff. So apart from Jennifer Lawrence, what else did you like?
Well, the other actor I really thought did a good job was Bradley Cooper.
You liked him again.
So I was a big fan of The Silver Linings Playbook, which was David O. Russell's previous film.
Yep.
His first film with Jennifer Lawrence.
Yep.
And Bradley Cooper. And they're all reunited in this film again. And I just think there's real chemistry between Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. I think when he's on the screen, he's a massively calming influence on the whole mood of the film, and it feels like there's a drive and a sense of purpose and direction to the whole
story. But I mean,
that
doesn't come across as that good thing, because he's not in it very much.
Well, and again, this is slightly the problem. I feel like, well, we were trying to do positives, aren't we?
Oh,
like,
yeah. No, I'm just saying that's an odd thing to say for positive, because he was so hardly in it.
But when he was in it, I really enjoyed it when
Fine.
He was there.
Yeah.
And there's just so much chemistry between him and Jennifer Lawrence, I thought.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, he wasn't too bad. We can come back to him later, because I think he's probably in my negatives, yeah.
Right, okay. Well, what did you like about the film, Larry?
Well, I really liked the way that it looked. You know, the real life lady was doing her stuff in the 90s, but to me it looked like a sort of colourful 70s film. There was kind of a colourful, wild sense to a lot of the stuff. Then it was in your face a lot, and it felt alive, and it felt quite vivid.
Well, I agree with you. I think that there was a real look and quality to the production values of the film. I really liked the house that Joy lives in. I thought had lots of character.
Yep.
And it was a character in the film. So you saw the mother's room, the basement where both her father and her ex-husband are living. It was all kind of weirdly Wes Anderson.
I know what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
A lot of quite intense framing, a lot of still shots, and a lot of, using places to tell part of the story as opposed to settings for the drama. You're right. So the house was kind of part of all that. And I also liked, there were a couple of directorial choices that I did like very much. So did you notice that in some of the dialogue scenes, he deliberately stays on a character who's just delivered a line of dialogue in a conversation, and the person who's responding to that is off screen, and you stay with one person throughout the entirety of a conversation? They did that quite a lot. Did you notice?
I did notice it. I noticed it at one point in particular. I thought it really worked.
It's quite clever, I thought. I've not noticed that before in a film, and maybe that's a bad sign. Sometimes they say when this stuff is good, you don't notice it.
Did you feel like the camera was a character in the film, or did it feel like it was a fly on the wall for you? Sometimes you get cameras that are leading you. They're very present in the scene, and you sort of feel their motion and movement onto different characters.
Sure.
And sometimes Steven Spielberg, famously, he very much tries for you not to notice the camera work. And it silently glides around to whoever's
sure.
needed to be on screen.
From that point of view, yes, I suppose it did, because I felt conscious that I was being forced to remain on one character. So the camera was telling me, this is who you need to observe.
And you liked that, and that worked for you?
I thought it was quite clever. I enjoyed seeing someone react in a conversation, because it was much more to do with. It was less about the drama and more about the people.
Well, so it's funny you mention that, because something which I'm aware of with David O. Russell, when in his previous film was American Hustle, that one with Jeremy Renner and Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence again and Christian Bale.
Yeah, yeah. That's got wild costumes and settings and stuff, so I can see that similarity.
Yeah, you can see the sort of threads plowing onto his new film. David Russell has sort of said in the past, roughly, he's not that concerned with plot. He's much more concerned with character, which I think is slightly problematic.
Okay.
But it's interesting that you pulled that out, because that lines up quite nicely with what you enjoyed about the film.
Yeah, and I've only really got one major other thing that I liked, which was I liked the choice of subject matter. I thought I was quite fascinated by that. Oh, right. It's nice to know that there's a story behind the creation of, you know, a seemingly slightly inane object. And I thought, to begin with, I was quite excited to watch the movie. By the end, I wasn't so sure.
Well, interesting. It seems like you've got some issues. Do you want to go into that now?
Well, let's talk. Yeah, so let's talk the bad stuff. I've been talking for a while. What were the bads?
Well, so
That's terrible English. What were the bads? What were they?
Well, the bads were, I feel like the film didn't really know what it wanted to be. I thought it was messy, and the direction in particular I thought was very, very confused, very uncertain. I felt like at times it wanted it to be sort of an emotional journey and very much character-driven and family-focused. Then other times I thought it was trying to be a black comedy and sort of Wes Anderson-y characters and things like that. And then other times I thought almost it was like a fable with the grandmother's narration on over the film right from the start of Joy's childhood onwards, upwards. But I think all of that was the wrong approach.
Yep.
The film actually worked for me best when it was mostly just focusing on the story of the inventor of this product, a biopic almost. When the camera wasn't sort of being a big influence on what you were seeing, it was sort of sitting back and allowing the story to unfold. I thought when the film was strongest and when it felt most comfortable for me watching. How about you, Laurie?
No, I completely agree. That was my major thing, is the tone is all over the place. It's so strange because a particular moment in the film, suddenly everything changes and it becomes something completely different. And then it doesn't stay there. It doesn't stay put. I kind of don't want to give anything away, but it really reminded me of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It was very bizarre. Suddenly you've got these larger-than-life characters and it's like a dream world and kind of everything is suddenly blown out of proportion and strange. Characters suddenly start behaving in quite odd ways and then it becomes, like you said, a bit of a black comedy. It becomes almost like a revenge piece. And then there was the strangest bit at the end, and you know, this isn't a spoiler, but I think even the director seems to know this because he chops up the narrative. He chops up the timeline towards the end. And it gets even messier. It's like, it's sort of cooking a cake and thinking, oh, it's not quite right. It's too bland. Let's throw in a bit of tarragon and then not leaving it there and throwing in cherries on top. And I don't even know what else. Caraway seeds.
Like those little tiny smarty things that you put inside the little
candies. One of those. And then by the end of it, you've got this cake on the bake sale that kind of everyone looks at and says is very impressive, but no one really wants to eat it.
I think, on top of that, I think the editing as well was really, really bad. I didn't like the editing at all. It seemed to be, I was like on a roller coaster in the first half of the movie. And as I said, Bradley Cooper, he's kind of like a calming influence on the film. Once he's there, the whole film slows down and it slightly just takes a breath. And it's almost like the first half of the film, setting up the family, they're rushing through it as quickly as possible, just trying to get to the actual story part.
Yeah, sure.
But then that doesn't make sense. Why would you rush through something which you're spending so much time?
No, I agree. It was a lot. It felt very, very long. I couldn't believe that it didn't end at a certain point because I thought, well, that's it.
Yeah.
But it was just so weirdly paced. And it's odd, isn't it, how even if we don't understand like the language of cinema and we ourselves aren't familiar with all the structural tricks that scriptwriters employ, we all do expect them.
Mm.
And it wasn't there. It was just very, very weird.
What's really interesting was I actually listened to a Radio 1 interview of Jennifer Lawrence. That she was sort of reviewing her films, and she mentioned Joy in this film, and she mentioned working with David O. Russell, the director.
Yeah.
And one quote that sort of stuck out to me was this: "A David O. Russell film is so sporadic, and David is always having ideas and creating. There's actually no point reading the script."
She said that?
That's what she said.
Oh, ouch.
Well, no, but the thing is she loves working with this guy, obviously, because she's done 3 films with them, and she's won an Oscar for one of the films.
Okay, fair enough.
So she really likes working with him. But it does make me think this guy, who's written this film as well as directing it, he's sort of this weird bundle of energy, and it's really hard to understand what the thought process
perhaps
were.
Perhaps that's, you know, a byproduct of success, because those 3 films you're talking about have all been in like the last 3 years, haven't they? Mm. Last 2 years?
Yeah, so he's had a rapid sort of rise in estimation. But in the film, I just felt like midway through he was having a change of heart on what film it should be. and having to kind of reconcile it with his earlier creative decisions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's why I think even more credit to Jennifer Lawrence for managing to remain consistent and delivering a performance.
Sure.
When it's so completely jarring, the tones.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm with you. And I think, you know, final other things, you know, the characters suddenly became pantomime characters and he stopped spending the time that was needed to try and understand them. So, you know, when you've got a difficult character in a film, part of the fun of the movie is that you kind of come to understand why they're difficult or you appreciate them as a rounded character. And I felt like we were getting that at the beginning with the difficult home life with her sister and her father, you know, and this Trudy, who's, I really liked Trudy very much. I thought she was playing well.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Isabella Rossellini, was it not?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it was, yeah. Right. But then there came a point in the film where they all suddenly became pastiches. They all suddenly became very thin and quite mean-spirited. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
And it just, the characters all fell apart. All the hard work for setting it up just fell away completely. There was no close to that.
I wonder if it's actors sort of putting in lots of energy and effort into their characters, but actually not having thought through their characters to the full extent later on in the film.
Kind of falls away.
Yeah, they don't have a conclusion to those characters and why they are that way.
Very much agreed. And a sort of final positive to end on. One thing I did do, and we haven't really talked about the theme, because I'm not really sure what the message of the film is. I'm not really sure. You could say it's a message about sticking to your guns or whatever and kind of going through and believing in yourself. But I don't think that is what it's about, really, because it's quite empty if that's the case. But I would say it paints a pretty good picture of the miserable and cruel world of business.
Yeah, and I think also it highlights the number of failures you have to have.
Exactly that, because you have, punctuated throughout the film, you have rocketeering successes and people who have absolutely made it beyond a shadow of a doubt and people who've got nothing.
And fail again and again
complete,
and again.
Complete failure. And that was good. That was quite uncompromising and it had me sort of on tenterhooks. I felt quite tense and not entirely happy leaving the film, if you know what I mean.
I have to say, I was interested in the character that Joy is based on. And after the film was ended, I went on Wikipedia and looked her up, because it's an interesting story. There's something very interesting there. I think ultimately the film has something interesting in it. I'm not sure about the direction.
Yeah, yeah. So there you go. We've tried not to give anything away. Lots to be interested in. Probably worth a go. It's you know, it's going to be talked about a lot, I would imagine. And it is interestingly directed. I'd be really interested to hear. Did you guys enjoy it? Did you wish it was something slightly different? What did direction put you off, or did you love Jennifer Lawrence?
I would have to give this film, if I was giving it a grade, I would give it a C+.
C+.
Which is quite harsh. I thought there was so much working against it. If it was just based on the direction and style, I think I'd probably give it a lower grade than that. I think certain things keep it on track to make it an acceptable film, but ultimately I think it's a very good failure.
Interesting. I didn't dislike it. It was just odd. Maybe I will give it I think we're going to agree on this one. I do C+ as well. Yeah.
Cool.
I thought I preferred it to Spectre, in other words.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe I... Well... Oh, we shouldn't go down this road, man. We should never have nailed our colours to the mast.
This is the thing, man. You got to put your money where your mouth is.
Well, there we are.
Laurie, there's a film I think you should see.
A film? But do I trust you to give me such a recommendation?
Well, that is entirely...
That was inside my head, Phil. I'm speaking out loud for the benefit of the listeners. But
you need to do a special thought voice then for listeners.
Special thought voice. Okay. I'm interested in this, but do I trust Phil's opinions?
Have you ever had that happen to you, Laurie, where somebody's recommended you a film and then you're not sure whether or not you should trust them or not?
Of course I have. Yeah, that's a very common one. Mainly, I think I've been on the other side, because when I try and recommend films to people, I tend to see their faces kind of go in on themselves and I can tell they're thinking,
Yeah.
The last film Laurie said I should watch was Gladiator over Christmas, so maybe,
Well, have you ever watched a film and then found out it was a really bad recommendation?
I'm trying to think of an exact example of that. Certainly I've watch films that people recommended that I haven't enjoyed at all. Like, personally, I didn't really like Man on Fire very much, even though everyone recommends that one.
Okay, yeah, I quite like that film.
Yeah, I did enjoy it.
How do you work out who's trustworthy and who's not when it comes to films? It's a lot of time invested in films. You're sitting there most of the time for 2 hours. Do you want to have a stinker or do you want to have a gold?
Even more in the cinema, because you've got to pay.
Exactly. And so how on earth do you work out if you should listen to that person or not?
Yeah.
And I reckon this is a test that I've worked out for me personally. I wonder if you'd agree with me that this is the right way to go.
This is a sort of cast iron, here's your formula, apply this and you'll know whether to take that recommendation at face value.
Yeah, totally. It's a litmus test on whether or not their opinion matches with my film taste.
Go on, hit us with it.
So my litmus test is Lost in Translation.
Oh, right. Okay. I love that film.
You love that film. The thing is it's not about loving the film. It's not about what you think of the film in some ways as a good film or a bad film. It's whether or not you have an opinion on that film. So I've heard,
everyone has an opinion who's seen it, surely.
Well, so you think so, but I think there's a key thing with Lost in Translation. Some people would watch that movie and they'd say nothing happened.
Okay.
Nothing happened in that film.
I've come across this opinion.
And I've found that is my litmus test for whether or not I can see. It's like a little guide on where they stand in the film world.
You're going to have to explain yourself because that's quite a generalizing statement.
So it is quite a generalizing statement. And I don't want to discredit anyone who said that nothing happened in that film. What I mean is Lost in Translation is almost entirely based around the subtleties of film and what it conveys. So either you watch that film and you feel like it says loads, because I think it does say loads, using the kind of subtle character interactions, directions, music, everything, the shots, all of it, I think contributes to saying something quite deep and loud and complex. But some people watch that film and it just goes right over their head, and it makes me think, for me personally, I can kind of say, I don't need to listen to you.
Very interesting. I mean,
films.
You know, if I was being a stickler for, you know, well-constructed arguments at this point, Phil, I would say that that's just your opinion, isn't it?
Well, so this is the thing. This is a one which I worked out for me personally,
okay,
as a litmus test, and I'm putting it out there.
That's fair enough. So you're saying this isn't you don't think everyone should apply Phil's filter?
It's not, yeah, Phil's filter.
Everyone needs
Phil's
to work out their own one.
Mm,
but then how, you're saying that the only reason you came to that conclusion was by talking to other people.
Yeah, and I'd be just interested. I guess what I'm doing is throwing it out there to find out what other people's test might be, to work out how to take somebody's advice or suggestions.
I think, you know, one that would work for me would be the film I Spy with Eddie Murphy and Owen Wilson.
Oh, yeah, I like that film.
That film, if you haven't seen it, it's a sort of spoof spy film. Not really in the vein of Johnny English. I think it's cleverer than Johnny English. And I quite like Johnny English. I'll freely admit that. I bet I've lost a lot of respect from a lot of people there. But, you know, if you want a sort of Christmas film where you've had too much of the mulled wine and your brain doesn't really function, Johnny English is fine. But I Spy is a cut above. I think there's great performances, brilliant dialogue, just hilarious scenes. And it's a very, very satisfying experience. But I know that loads of people hate it. The critics didn't love it, certainly.
It didn't do very well. It was considered a bit of a bomb, wasn't it? Eddie Murphy and Owen Wilson. I thought they were great. Had a great little rapport between them.
Yeah, totally. So, well, fair enough. Maybe that's one of my litmus tests. Lost in Translation, absolutely. And I completely agree with you, by the way. I think that film says everything. I love it.
But what's interesting is you don't have to like what it says. You just have to think it says something.
Okay,
that's
as opposed to nothing.
As opposed to nothing.
Fine.
So it's not about good or bad, Lost in Translation.
Well, so listeners, at this point, you might be thinking, you could do a bit of reverse psychology on this one, which isn't the right phrase, but I'm using it anyway. You could kind of think to yourself, well, if that's what Phil thinks, if that film is so important to him and he feels that it says loads, and if you felt it didn't say anything or nothing happened, maybe that tells us a little bit about Phil.
Maybe
it's such a personal endeavor. So what does that say about Phil? Maybe you're thinking that.
Well, I'd be interested to hear. I quite like those little personality tests
sure
you do online.
fair enough. Okay, so what? We're just asking listeners to know what their litmus test is.
Yeah, how do they work out whether or not they match up with somebody else and if they're going to agree with what they think about films?
Sure, sure. But of course, Phil, you recommended Man on Fire to me.
Did I?
Yeah, I'm sure you liked. Do you like the film?
Yeah, I did like it.
Exactly. So that's a recommendation from you. I didn't like it.
So
it can't quite work. Or maybe this is just, it doesn't apply to me.
You need to find your own one, Laurie. This
I
is what I'm
find
saying.
My own one. Well, that's interesting. But by your own logic, man, the fact that you like Man on Fire and I don't means that there must be other things that show our difference in films.
But what I will say is there's a quality to Man on Fire. Even if you didn't like it, it's still a film. It's film working on a different level, isn't it?
No, it's wish fulfillment for angry young men. That's what I say.
Oh, right,
Phil.
Okay.
Maybe that is my litmus test then, but that's
what Man
what
of Fire is yours.
Yeah, I mean, it does not one I would imagine has a broad range. I can't imagine my mum, for example, has a strong feeling about it, having, I can't imagine, ever wanted to watch it.
Well, she's a funny one because she watches, she's seen Dodgeball. And
she did go and watch Dodgeball.
She went to see Wanted as well.
Wanted and Dodgeball. Oh, what are you doing? Well, come on, you must have had an experience where someone's recommended something to you and you didn't like it.
Somebody has recommended to me What Happens in Vegas.
Oh, yeah. And Ashton Kutcher.
Ashton Kutcher.
Whatever his name is, yeah.
But I still haven't watched it. I refuse to watch that film.
You haven't even watched it?
No.
Well, that doesn't count then, man.
What can I say, Laurie? My litmus test works so well that I don't watch films.
Listeners, are you hearing this? Like, he's spending all his time coming up with litmus tests rather than actually watching these recommended films. Boo. I'm just with pins of pantomimes. Boo. Boo.
I'm just trying to put it out there, you know, trying to contribute to the podcast. So if you've got any ideas, email us in at superbaileybros.google. I got it wrong.
What are you talking about? superbaileybros@gmail.com.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks very much, Laurie. Always saving the day.
Always. Right. So here's the new one, the new segment.
Right.
I feel like I should have written an extra theme tune for it. Hey, maybe by the time this goes out, I will have, and it would go right here.
That's amazing.
You don't know whether I actually put it in yet. Okay, let's move on. So what have we been watching? Phil and I, you know, it's good. The holidays, we had plenty of time to sit down, no work to do. We got to slog in front of the TV, watch a few movies. It was brilliant.
I watched loads of movies over New Year's and Christmas.
We're not going to do all of them because I think that would bore everyone, but there's an off chance that we've seen something you haven't seen before. And you're interested to know what we thought. So kick us off, Phil.
I watched again The Theory of Everything.
Oh, yeah. The award-winning, I believe, Oscar-winning, in fact.
Yeah, Eddie Redmayne won an Oscar for his portrayal of Stephen Hawking.
Exactly.
And it's all about the relationship between Stephen Hawking and his wife, Jane. Felicity Jones. Yeah, I like Felicity Jones.
Yeah, she was great.
I thought, watching it again, I think it confirmed what I thought initially. That film has an amazing performance in it. But I have to say, you actually don't get to know Stephen Hawking from that movie really any much better. It actually kind of tricks you because you think it's going to be about him and it ends up being all about his wife.
Well, I mean, it was based on her accounts, was it not?
Yeah, and it's much more of a relationship character drama than it is about the difficulties he goes through with his diagnosis and his sort of eventual entrapment in the wheelchair.
I mean, I agree and I disagree at the same time because I thought it was an amazing retelling of this guy's life. It's such an extraordinary life in so many ways, and previously I'd just been aware of Stephen Hawking as he is today, and to see it this way I suddenly thought, oh right, that's how it came to be that this guy is doing what he's doing in his condition but has also had such extraordinary breakthroughs. I wasn't that interested to know Stephen Hawking the man. I was more interested to know about his life and his work, and I felt it delivered pretty well.
Yeah, okay, if you're going into the film for that, I think it's a great movie.
Yep.
Definitely a solid movie. Definitely really incredible performance by Eddie Redmayne.
It's astonishing.
Definitely deserves his Oscar.
Absolutely.
I can't believe how much he disappears and Stephen Hawking is just there on screen.
I completely agree, and it's a very richly realised period piece. Like, everything in it looks immaculate and brilliant.
Yeah, so that's what I've been watching this week. Loved it.
Nice. Well, I'll start off with Daddy's Home, because I saw that at the cinema with my wife. This is Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg's most recent film. You know, Will Ferrell, he's been on a bit of a run of not quite stinkers, but pretty average output. You know, it makes you wonder if he's got a mortgage or something that he's trying to pay off. But it really is very average Will Ferrell fare, with some nice little moments and some positively bad things thrown in as well.
Where would you put it in comparison to The Other Guys? That was the other Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg
film. I actually preferred it to The Other Guys because there
was... Did you?
Yeah, I did. The Other Guys was too surreal for me, and it played too much to Will Ferrell's own sort of comedy nooks. I think he retreats to things that he finds funny when he doesn't have that many ideas, and that film was full of it in a really odd way. Remember his whole gator thing?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was so funny.
I wasn't into that so much. This one, I thought it was straight down the line. The narrative was pretty ordinary. It's a stepdad, and sort of nice, kind stepdad who's trying really hard to be accepted by his new kids, his new family, and then their actual dad turns up, and he's this leather jacket wearing rock star like Mark Wahlberg, who's muscly and really cool.
Oh, so Will Ferrell's the stepdad, not the actual dad.
Yeah, an unusual way around. And that was quite nicely played out dynamic. I believed, even though Will Ferrell is a complete caricature, it works quite well. There were some nice little cameos in it. I'll say that the last scene made both me and my wife laugh a lot, but it's quite a lot of film to watch for one good scene. And a lot of the rest of it is predictable, it's slapstick. I thought it was very crude, considering that it's a 12A and the whole cinema was filled with kids. Personally speaking, I wouldn't have taken my kids to see that.
Oh.
And I know that you know, other people will disagree, and you know, that's totally fine. But
old man Laurie.
I know, I just thought it was a bit over the line in places, and some of the, you know, there are whole scenes of stuff that kids wouldn't understand and just wasn't. No, you only will laugh at that if you're a parent or, you know, an old, experienced, world-weary adult. And I'd like to introduce at this point my wife, Judith, who's just walked by at the wrong moment. Unlucky Jude. What did you think of the film?
Daddy's Cool. I thought...
It's not called Daddy's Cool. Oh. It's called Daddy's Home. if anyone hasn't heard Judith on this podcast before, there's a good test for how well she remembered the film. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I didn't think the daddies were cool. Maybe that's why I'm thinking that. I liked Will Ferrell. I thought he was all right, but I didn't like the other guy. He's not my kind of idea of a hunky, hunky man. My favourite...
Unlucky Laurie.
My favourite scene was the last bit that made me laugh a lot. I did fall asleep, so I don't know if that's an indication of how well I liked it. But I think I agreed with Laurie in that the first thing that came into my mind when I came out was I would not want to take my child to see that film.
Thank you very much, Judith. You can go away now.
Thanks, Judith.
Bye. We might get her back in a minute. That was pretty good. Yeah, I totally agree. You know, Mark Wahlberg is this cool dad. What was weird was their reference point for a cool dad seemed to be stuck in, like, I don't know, the 80s. He was like a biker guy wearing, like, with long hair in a leather jacket. I don't think that's in.
Wow.
Has it ever been in?
Well.
Okay, yeah, next one. Give us another.
I caught on TV, you know how during the holiday season, there's loads of movies playing on TV. I also caught, again, What Women Want. You know that Mel Gibson film?
What Women Want? Yes, I do know that film with Helen Hunt and Mel Gibson.
Yeah, in 2000, it was 15 years ago it was released. 16 years ago now, actually, I guess.
You were about to tell me that it feels like longer.
It does feel like longer. Because I can't believe it, man. The amount of sort of misogynistic things that movie says, both by Mel Gibson, who is in the film, is misogynistic.
Yeah.
I really liked this film back in the day.
Yeah.
But watching it again, it was making me cringe. 2016 would not be happy with Mel Gibson. Or indeed any of the characters in the film, because even the women are sort of quite disparaging about themselves as a race. I want to say a race.
No, don't say that.
Okay, what should I say? Educate me, Laurie.
People,
as a people, as a group.
Not as a people, just women is fine.
Women.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
That even the women are quite sort of generic about their own womenness.
Yeah, it's a funny one. This is the film where, I don't know, most people will probably have seen it. It's where... this misogynistic guy who's a real smooth talker or whatever and gets loads of women, you know, that's the kind of phrase that they bandy around. A lightning bolt strikes and he's suddenly...
able to hear what women think.
That's exactly right. Can hear what all the women around him think. And he suddenly is horrified to realise they don't really think he's all that. And he becomes very sensitive and, you know, and he starts to understand women a lot better. And although he initially uses it for his own gain, he sort of mellows out by the end.
No. For most of the film, okay. He uses it for his own gain. It's unbelievable. Even when he's being nice to the women, he's sort of manipulating them and getting his own results.
It's unbelievable. Funny, because as much as we'd roll our eyes at a lot of it back then and, you know, laugh at it, because it's quite a well-made movie and it's quite witty. There's some witty scenes and some clever comedy, like comic approaches. But it is amazing. If you want to see how much the world has changed in 15 years, that is a good one to try.
It felt like, you know, you go back in time and sometimes when you speak to old people, you suddenly get a glimpse of the past.
Yeah.
Of old values. It was genuinely like a time warp.
Surprising.
Weird. But at the same time, it's a very solid movie in terms of the structure and all those sort of aspects.
It's very well made. Good performances.
It's an absolute hit the nail on the head rom-com. Just a bit outdated.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there, man. Good one, yeah. Okay, my next one. I watched a film on DVD called Age of Adeline. I'm slightly nervous about saying what I thought of this one.
Why are you nervous, sorry?
Well, over the holidays, my mum was given it, and I agreed to watch it with my dad kind of very diplomatically suggesting I might not enjoy it. And I'm sorry to say, Mum, that he was right. I didn't really enjoy it. The film is basically this woman in the 20s, I think, at the age of 29, she has an accident, and there's a lightning bolt, and a whole bunch of things happen at the same time that means she stops aging.
Oh, right.
She stopped, exactly, yeah. It's quite a nice setup, right? She stops aging. And so you think, whoa, what's going to happen with this? And she suddenly discovers it and the FBI wants to see her because...
Oh, right.
Yeah, well, and it's partly because she has to move around and change her identity because people start asking strange questions and the police don't believe she's 45 and all this kind of thing. And so and then you meet this woman in the present day and she's been jumping around for, you know, 60, 70 years and surviving this way. And she's obviously very lonely. Her daughter is now a grandmother herself and very, very old. So that's the kind of setup. And, well, I can see no one on the listening can see Phil's face, but I can see I've piqued your interest. And also, let me add on top of that, Harrison Ford's in it.
Oh, yay.
Harrison Ford.
That's the lamest response ever I've said. Oh, cool. Yeah.
Cool, yeah. And he's, you know, they were a little goatee as well. You think an actor of quality like that, it made me really interested in the film in a way I hadn't expected to. But the problem is, with all that promise And it really is beautifully shot and beautifully made up. It tells the most boring, dreary love story I think I've seen ever. No passion. I thought there's a sort of really cliched, oh, but we mustn't. You know, oh, but I can't. You know, that kind of thing going on throughout the entire film. But she's not appealing in any way. She's a insufferable know-it-all who's very cold. I didn't like Blake Lively in the lead role
at all.
She's
a very beautiful lady.
Yeah, but beauty is only skin deep, Phil. I don't know if you ever heard that before.
Oh, right, okay.
And she wasn't appealing. She wasn't interesting. And people hopelessly fall in love with her. And there's all this melodrama about it. I just think, why would they not just stick with the actual drama of the setup? They make it a very tedious and dreary love affair, basically.
Well, I know. I hear what you're saying. I have to say, it's piqued my interest enough that I've ignored everything you said. Oh. I still kind of want to see it.
This is exactly what happened to me. This is what our dad was saying, man, and I should have listened to him a bit more clearly. I think he quite enjoyed it, to be fair. What I will say it had going for it, though, is Harrison Ford, what a good performance.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, he's really good in it. He actually brings some kind of weight and interest to this pretty awful role that he's been given. When you realise what they're doing with his role, you'll be quite disappointed. But he does it well, and he does... A thing I suddenly noticed is a Harrison Ford thing. I wonder if you'll know that. I wonder if you'll be able to picture this. There's a bit where he goes into an old warehouse to try and find a photo that he's forgotten about, and he suddenly realizes it's really important that he goes to find this photo. And the problem is, in the doors of the warehouse bits, the little shed in their big house complex, there's brooms and there's boxes in the way. So he kind of pushes through and he stumbles over these boxes, but he does it with an air of, I've got to get this thing. And it was like, whoa. He's really got to get that thing. Like, it's the most convincing stumbling through a doorway. Harrison Ford is your man.
Is that a unique gift of Harrison Ford?
I'm not joking. I know it's very hard, and I know it's hard to believe. If you watch that and you see him do that, if you've seen The Fugitive, if you've seen any of the Harrison Ford films that are not Star Wars, you'll totally recognize it. Even Indiana Jones, it was brilliant. He still got it, man.
I think I'm going to watch this movie, man.
Oh, whoops.
Maybe I'll be saying you were right. Maybe I'll be saying you're wrong. Maybe this is a movie court for later.
As I say, our mum will love it if you say that I'm wrong.
Maybe I'm just trying to score points.
Have you got one more?
Yep. The last film, I haven't actually watched this since I got it for Christmas. I'm really excited to see it again. It's the movie Her.
Oh, yeah. Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin Phoenix, Spike Jones. Basically, the plot of the movie is Joaquin Phoenix is this sort of hopeless romantic guy who's very lonely, and it's sort of set in the near future, and they've just released a iOS program, kind of like Siri, you know, for the iPhone, but a much more advanced one. And it's so advanced that it kind of adapts and learns and is its own AI, and it becomes a person that this Joaquin Phoenix guy knows, and then they start falling in love.
Thanks. That's a good description of the setup. And when I read that description, I thought, there is no way ever I'm going to go and watch this film.
I know exactly why you say that. But if you have seen any of the trailers for that movie, or if you just see the look of that movie, I think you'll change your mind.
That's partly why I didn't want to watch it. It's Joaquin Phoenix is a hipster. And I thought, oh, what Apple-loving sycophant has written this?
But the thing is that's not actually what the movie is. It's almost like a critique of that.
Okay.
Apple sycophant, to use your words. I don't really know what sycophant is. But anyway, I'm assuming I do. It's a critique of our technology and our isolation. You know how in Wall-E they're all fat slobs looking at screens.
In the future, this is mankind have become, they just sit in front of their sort of iPads all day.
Yeah, this is kind of like the first steps in that sort of direction. And it's a beautifully shot visual film. I love the it's just far enough in the future to make it feel kind of familiar yet alien. And I just think Joaquin Phoenix does a really good job. Scarlett Johansson is the voice of this AI, and she's just wonderfully enchanting. And you kind of believe that somebody could have almost like an extreme version of a long distance relationship.
Really?
And it kind of suckers you in. And what I really love about this film is the fact that it explores its idea to the fullest extent. I have a lot of respect for films which have a concept and they see it through right to the very end of where that idea can take them. And I found it really satisfying, really solid performance, really just beautiful. And
interesting.
That's not something which I normally say about
movies. You've nearly sold me on that, because I have to admit, and I suspect I speak for several others as well, when you hear the premise, it just seems like the most sort of self-congratulatory, artsy film in the world. But you have made it sound like it might have a narrative in it.
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay, interesting. Okay, last one from me, and then we'll move on. I think this segment's going pretty well, Phil.
Yeah.
Oh, so interesting. I saw Midnight in Paris.
Oh, I love that movie.
Owen Wilson and what's her name? Marion Coutard.
French.
We need to stop actually guessing these names.
I know them. You never know them.
And yeah, in Paris with a fiance and kind of falling in love with nostalgia. And it was a nice little rumination on, you know, is it a foolish thing to imagine, I wish I was born 50 years before. That was when the world was really good. That was when art was wonderful. That was when everything was super nice. And it's a nice little critique of that as they mysteriously, Owen Wilson finds himself transported back to the time of the group who lived in Paris, headed by Gertrude Stein. Pablo Picasso was there, all those guys, Hemingway.
Hemingway.
And it was quite fun. I wasn't sure how I was going to deal with it when all these famous writers and poets and co started turning up. But it does win you over the more you watch it. And it's so lighthearted and it's so beautiful. Paris looks absolutely magnificent. The music is lovely. The performances are great. Owen Wilson, man, I could watch him forever, I think. I think he's so talented.
He's particularly great in that movie. He's very likeable and warm, and he's very gentle in how he takes you, engages you in the film, I think.
And the longer you watch it, the more you buy into the whole conceit and you allow it to happen. I think what I was quite glad of, and what I realised while I was watching it, was that, you know, Woody Allen, who's the director and the writer here, I've started not to like him because his recent output has become a little bit insufferable, I think. He's a really interesting guy, but sometimes his style comes across as very patronising, and I was worried that was going to be the case here. And I did think, I really enjoyed the film, but I had to basically forget that it was made by Woody Allen.
Really? I was very aware it was a Woody Allen film. I think he's really talented when it comes to showing off a city.
There's no doubt that his ability is extraordinary, but I just think some of the cliches and the character types and the story ideas in there are so Woody Allen, and it's like he's trying to teach us all what love really is. And I don't think Woody Allen knows.
Woody.
Yeah, I don't want to be taught what love really is by Woody Allen. I don't think he knows. I don't think, you know, it's a mystery. That's the whole point about
that. That's an interesting angle on a Woody Allen film.
Yeah, maybe I'm a bit pompous to say that, but I would recommend that one to anyone. Even if you don't know all these artists and authors, you'll still be able to enjoy it because they do enough self-explanation. And I should say, I didn't know half of any of the people who turned up in the film, but I loved it, yeah.
And if you do know them, it's like a bonus because then you get all the points from spotting.
All the points. Points. I actually recognised that one. I did actually do that. That's exactly what I did.
Exactly,
when T.S. Eliot turned up, I was like, oh, yeah, it's actually T.S. Eliot.
Yes, he was in Paris at that time.
It's funny because it sort of tricks you into being one of the characters they make fun of in that film.
Yeah.
He walks around pretending like he knows everything. And then when all these characters start popping up, all you want to do is say, oh, I know that one.
They did that and they just said, oh, actually, funny enough, they didn't do that. Yeah. So there you go. That's another little aspect of the film.
So yeah, there we go. That's what, six films we've gone through. Hopefully a good enough pace. I hope it was interesting and not boring to hear us go on about it. Quite interested to know if you go and see any of those.
Yeah, let us know. And let us know if you had your own thoughts on those films, if you disagree, agree. All that jazz. We love having emails.
And all that jazz. And, you know, we hope to do this one fairly regularly because we're going to, Super Betty Bros in Movie Land is going to become a fortnightly podcast. And so we'll have a bit more time on our hands to catch up with stuff. If there's anything you'd like us to watch, let us know.
Yeah, we'd love to have suggestions. I'll use my litmus test and then we can have a watch. We might not necessarily like the movies you suggest, just so you know, we're not going to
be
sugarcoating it and being kind to our listeners. We won't be rude, hopefully, but...
No, of course not. And, you know, as you've just said, Phil, they'll apply their own litmus test to you.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
There we go. Phil, I hope you don't mind, but I'm just going to have a little bit of chocolate here before I... In fact, while I intro this segment. Is that all right with you?
Well, what are you eating?
I'm actually pretending to eat. How was that? Was that good?
Well, I don't know. I'm looking at you right now, though.
You should have. Yeah, okay. What is the deal, man? There are films I've seen recently. The Martian is the first one that springs to mind, where the lead character is talking to you or talking to someone else, and they've just got their mouth, they're chewing on food in like the most unpleasant way. It's horrible. Like, listen to this clip from The Martian. I hope we managed to get the clip.
Yeah. If not, we'll just put that in.
So, I gotta figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist.
Oh, wow, that's... Ooh.
See, I don't like that. And I think it's amplified, or sort of the effect is multiplied when you hear it without seeing him do it. But what is that? That cannot not be a directorial choice. Why do they do it?
I don't know. I think there's lots... It's not just a unique to that film, is it, though? It's in loads of films.
I mean, you can probably think of some as well. The one that jumps to my mind is Ocean's 11, where Brad Pitt in that film, the first one, he just eats constantly while he's
eating
talking.
In pretty much every scene, isn't he?
Why? Is that a character thing? What are we supposed to think? He's like one of the fittest, most muscly guys on the planet.
Apparently, allegedly, according to J.J. Abrams, I heard him talking about eating in films. If you're eating an apple, apparently, you always look like you're super confident and cocky. Somehow it communicates some sort
eating
of...
Eating an apple?
Apparently, eating an apple, you automatically look calm, collected, and
has any of his characters
confident.
Ever eaten an apple?
Yeah, Captain Kirk, when he's doing his little exam in
he's
Star Trek Academy or something like that, he's eating an apple.
That is such a bizarre... How on earth did he realise that?
Well, he just apparently he knew it. Maybe it's some sort of secret director's club. They know exactly what sort of food to eat. So if you're feeling nervous, you go for a trifle. And,
is that actually true?
No.
You're making that up. Okay, not trifle. Oh, I would be nervous if I was eating a trifle.
You go with jelly because then you could see the jelly shaking.
Wibble, wobble, wibble. So, you know, maybe is that a top tip for an interview there? If you've got an interview coming up, get the apple out.
Just start eating. Yeah, you know, I'm really good with people.
Thank you very much. We may call you. We won't get out. That's the reaction you'll get.
That's what you'd say, definitely.
Yeah, of course. Well, any others you can think of?
Well, so also there's Denethor in Lord of the Rings Return of the King.
Oh, yeah, that's a famous one.
So Pippin is doing his little...
Very Scottish.
As Faramir strides off to the... Well, basically, it's a kind of...
He's riding off to his death, basically, isn't he? We think he is, anyway.
Tragic mission he's been sent on. And
by his own father.
Yeah, and Denethor, his dad, is just sat there listening to Pippin sing, eating, like, tomatoes.
I remember that because that one I think I can live with more because he doesn't do a lot of talking while he's eating, but you do spend a lot of time watching him eat, and he's cracking, you know, he's ripping apart the bones of a turkey, and he bites into tomatoes in the least practical way possible, so all the seeds spill out, like, ugh, you know, a head being squished or something, you know, that kind of thing.
Ugh.
Yeah, but and that very clearly is being used for effect there, because you've got this man, this deluded old man, eating his food in a gross way, and he looks like a sort of, he's gone nuts. And I think that's what you're supposed to think, like, this guy's lost it, and he's sending his son to his death while he's eating turkey.
But, so, I mean, there's clearly examples where food is, like, actually a really useful thing.
Well, let's do The Martian, then. So why is he eating when he says, broccoli from you, I'm a botanist, or whatever it is?
I think he's probably eating to convey he isn't on show for anyone. He's talking to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore maybe this is a big problem because you didn't like the fact that he was recording those things at all.
Well, it was pointless because no one he leaves them on Mars, no one's ever going to watch them. Why is he doing it?
Is that a spoiler?
It's not a spoiler. That's what he's recording stuff and leaves it on Mars, like, okay, one way or the other, whether he dies or lives, that's what he's doing.
Okay yeah, cool. Okay, maybe it's trying to communicate the fact that he's on his own, he doesn't need to worry about etiquette, he eats kind of grossly, he just does his thing. It's to show his situation. There's nobody there to witness his circumstance. There's no polite pretense that he has to meet. He is being 100% himself. He doesn't care if he's chewing with his mouth open.
Okay.
You know who really absolutely uses food a lot in his movies?
Who?
Quentin Tarantino.
Okay.
He uses food a lot, especially in Inglourious. That one, yeah. There's loads of food in that. There's at the very beginning, there's the milk which he drinks and consumes it with that farmer. He asks.
Oh, that's
milk.
Right. Such a tense scene. Oh, man, I loved that film.
And then also there's the scene again where Christoph Waltz's character is in a restaurant and he orders a particular dessert with cream on it. I don't know if you remember. And he gets a very particular dessert and you see him lathering on this loads of cream while Shoshana, the girl that had at the start of the movie run away from this Jew hunter, is at this restaurant scene as well. And it's all kind of showing his ridiculous tweeness versus the actual context of this girl who's been brutalized
by
this man.
She's terrified of him.
She's absolutely
terrified. And he's a very sinister man. And yet, well, maybe that's part of it. So food in that instance is being used as a kind of, it's a terrifying familiarity because here's someone who also eats and likes milk, which is quite a childish food. And again, likes to ladle cream onto a dessert, which is quite a childish thing and quite an ordinary thing when you juxtapose that with his evil intent and his completely unscrupulous and cruel manner. Then it becomes doubly awful because you see that he is a person as well as being awful. He's not just a monster.
He's a person who loves whipped cream.
Yeah, but also...
It's horrible.
Yeah, that's your fair point. But again, that's a very specific use and he's not so much eating as he's talking.
I see what you're saying. Maybe it's just to make Matt Damon relatable. Everyone eats.
I don't know, man. I don't think I can get aboard with it. I find it quite mystifying. The apple thing is very illuminating. J.J. Abrams and his confidence apple. I'll buy me a whole stack of those. But I'm curious, I'd be interested to know if anyone else comes across scenes where you've got people apparently randomly chowing down on a bite of something while they're talking. You know, apart from it being, well, very improper manners, I just find it a little off-putting and I'm curious about it.
You're so British, aren't you?
Well, yes. So we'll do our last bit of joy reviewing here, so we won't worry about revealing plot points in this, but there's not that much to add, I don't think, is there, Phil?
This is just for those people who've already seen the film and they just wondered what we thought of those particular moments that you don't want to discuss unless you've seen the film.
Well, let's do it that way. So what did you think of the moment when Bradley Cooper's character, she suddenly gets a meeting with him after failing so much to get this mop off the ground?
That was for me when the film calmed down and the editing slowed down. I felt like that was what the film should have been about. It should have been much more about the QVC shopping channel that she eventually sells a mop on. I think that's where the film naturally finds its rhythm.
See, I can totally disagree with you there, because I couldn't shake the weirdest... This is when I said, you know, Willy Wonka in the earlier review. That's what I felt it was like. It's like suddenly Bradley Cooper, having been this austere businessman who's trying to teach her about reality, suddenly it's like literally a door is open and there are these white rooms, completely white rooms of people being made up, and there's this magical audience where Joan Rivers is on stage. It's like a scene from Inside Out or Toy Story, do you know what I mean? Or Shrek or something. And it just was, and he was like this weird magical conductor saying, "Hit phones, Carl, come on, tell us this, show him the hands, and he's really into the hands. And I thought, why have you done that? Why have you turned Bradley Cooper into this Willy Wonka-like mystical figure who has the power to change destinies? And not only that, it made it seem like David O. Russell really loves QVC. He's got this really weird reference for it, as if showing us the first stages of television shopping was somehow a real watershed and a major moment. Whereas I think most people feel that teleshopping channels are a blight on society.
I don't know. Maybe for me, it worked like that. I see exactly what you're saying. I think that's probably how Joy, the character of Joy, sees it all. It's this crazy world of these sort of ridiculous over-the-top costumes and these ladies with loads of makeup and these revolving rooms and everything like that. TV is really weird and it is very strange, and you do have people sort of conducting these reactions.
And the revolving stage and all that? Is that even true? I'd love to know whether it
is. Yeah, I think it probably is. It wouldn't surprise me at all. I think that's the sort of thing which they would do to make it easier.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was fine. I think what's really jarring about that, and I can see why it might be jarring for you, is that the rest of the film is so bizarre and fable-like.
But that's exactly what I mean. At the beginning of the film was like a chaotic family drama, a bit like Silver Linings Playbook, and I quite liked it because there was a lot of chaos in it. And it was, you said you felt it was rushed. I didn't feel that. I felt like everything was just communicating, this is a desperate situation, wouldn't it be wonderful to find some way of making sense of it all? And then it became the most absurd kind of fantasy fairy tale when Bradley Cooper turned up.
See, that's so funny you say that, because I felt completely the opposite. That was when the film made sense to me and the characters made sense to me and the world made sense to me, because TV is ridiculous, real life isn't. And yet I thought the mum stuck in a bed, never moving, that weird constant referral back to that TV soap that they were watching.
Yeah.
All of that stuff, it just felt surreal.
That was
very And the
surreal.
Editing as well was just so rapid. And the scenes moved so quickly from... There was no time given.
I hear you. It is interesting because I like that more. That is interesting that we disagree on that.
We completely disagree on that.
But then I think that what that does sell is the fact that basically it's two different films. It's more than two different films all combined together. The tone was everywhere. And you were obviously expecting it and hoping it would be more like the film as revealed by Bradley Cooper's character, whereas I hoped and thought it might be more like the initial film.
But what's really strange is that the film doesn't have a clean switch. It kind of bounces back and forth. The scene which I found really odd was once Joy has Colin confronted that cowboy lawyer man.
Well, she did. He never said who he was, did he? Yeah.
They didn't really. You kind of had to assume it was the Dallas lawyer representative, the Hong Kong guy.
Yeah.
But she was walking out, and then suddenly the grandmother's narration comes back, and she says, "Oh, little did she know that all this was ahead
of
her."
That was a real mess.
And then suddenly you've got this really weird shot where it kind of takes you through this grand house that she's now living in, and it's almost like Wes Anderson, where the characters, as the movement through the house,
they're all there.
You're moving through a timeline.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Into the final kind of... It was such a weird way of showing.
It was very odd. And he did that twice. He had flash forward to the future. She didn't know that this would happen. And then it went back to her walking down the street. Then he did it again. He did that twice. It went back to her saying, she didn't know this was going to happen. And I thought, What are you doing? Happening? Like, what's the value in that? What's the value added by doing that in the direction? I don't think there was anything. In some ways, I thought he was trying to simulate a meaningful ending when there wasn't really one. Like, the only thing that needed to happen was that she overcame adversity, but he seems to have taken a dose of melodrama. Like, even the sort of, whatever you call it, when the protagonist gets brought right down to their very lowest point, the bankruptcy moment, and then have... that was a very painful scene. I struggled to watch it, actually, when she's there and having to file for bankruptcy. It was just awful because she'd been completely...
betrayed, basically.
Yeah, by her own family, and it's just awful. And you even got her ex-husband there who was right, and everyone knew that that was going to be the case. But that they brought her right down to the very bottom, and then it became a very, very odd kind of revenge drama where she made it all the way back up again. And
I felt like the movie needed to, what it should have done, rather than any sort of dramatic way of showing it with some creative Wes Anderson-y movement, I was just waiting for that sort of lovely black placard at the end of the film where the white text toes up.
Oh, that tells you about how they went on to do
blah, 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 blah. I love those moments in films. I love them in The Social Network. Yeah, I love them in any true story. If it's got any truth in it, I'm just waiting for that last title screen, basically, which tells you what happens to the characters. Mm. And I love them when they're sort of, they just show something amazing that you can, because the characters, you've already spent time with them, you don't need to see it in any sort of visual form.
Yeah.
You could just leapfrog and it's
in your
mind. And he
seems to have deliberately chosen to do that with narration and actual scenes, which was an odd move, wasn't it?
Yeah, the whole film was just so bizarre.
This kind of links into what I mentioned earlier, which is that obviously the way that it's made, you're supposed to come away, like that white text is there to make you think, oh, wow, and you're supposed to receive a message at that point. But I wonder even whether David O. Russell himself feels there isn't that much of a message there, because at the end of the day, that's how you use that football manager's phrase. It is just a story about a woman who became a success and got loads of money. You want it to be emotionally heft-worthy, and maybe that's why he did it the way that he did it. But it didn't need to be like that. It would have been enough just to show her overcoming it and succeeding and leaving it at that.
And actually, her family context didn't really contribute to why she's successful or why she wasn't successful. It was just like a lot of rubbish piled onto her.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Ironically, it could have used almost a Good Dinosaur-esque, very bland motto. Do you know what I mean?
Some sort of moniker to go back to.
Yeah, exactly. Given by a parental figure at the beginning that she then finally lives up to by the end. They tried to do that a little bit when her daughter said, that's what Mimi said to you. You were the one who was supposed to take this family on to good things, whatever it was. You're going to become this matriarch. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
They tried to do it, but that scene in the beginning of the film was kind of glossed over, so it didn't work. It didn't land.
And the other way they sort of tried to have a kind of thematic link was the origami paper box that she had.
Oh, right. They did another one because, exactly, that's what I'm saying. They felt they needed to.
And it didn't land either, because I think the main takeaway that I got from that was that she didn't need a man. She was going to be a princess, fairy tale princess who didn't need a man to be, that was her magic power or something like that.
Interesting.
But it was so bizarre and it's so clouded. And what I think throughout the whole film, what happens is it picks up certain elements that you think are going to recur and then drops them when you think they would come back. And then they pop up again when you're not expecting them.
I'd love to know what his goal was. And it's interesting the way that this film was trailed for me, because you know that scene, there's the scene where she's wearing black and she says, don't ever act on my behalf again to her sister.
Mm.
And that is in the trailers, and the trailers paint it as a woman who's really strong and standing up for herself, and let's all go check out this fine example of womanhood who sold a mop to housewives.
And it's even the beginning of the film is dedicated to strong women, isn't it?
Is that what it says?
It's something like that. There was some sort of title inspired by powerful women or something. And,
you know,
to
a certain extent that came across, because I did think, whoa, you did leave the film with a lot of respect for her having stood her ground and learned very fast lessons about business in terrible situations. She did it. That was brilliant. And like you said, I wanted to go and find out about the real woman because that was brilliant. But I don't think, it didn't seem like that was the message the direction was giving you.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it a couple of times. Like, I felt like the film wanted to be a fable. You had the grandmother who sort of was narrating and sort of giving wise words and encouraging her at various points in the movie, almost like a hero's tale, sort of against the various monsters and villains that she encounters.
Yeah.
But that's not really the story that is meant to be told.
Yeah, yeah.
It's meant to be a biopic. It's meant to be just the story of how this mop came to be and the person behind it. That's the sort of thing. The film, which I felt is an appropriate parallel, and maybe you disagree with me, this is Erin Brockovich.
Yeah, sure, fair enough. But because I mean, she's fighting a cause.
But it's the same time.
Yeah.
Erin Brockovich and Joy are kind of parallel characters. They're both real or based on real people. They're both single mums. They've both got a lot of hardship.
Yeah.
And they're both sort of independently fighting for what they want. Obviously, Erin Brockovich, it's more of a cause, but also there's a personal desire in that.
Yeah.
I think I'd prefer to watch Erin Brockovich over
Joy.
Well,
that's what I'm saying. It's a different film. David O. Russell doesn't seem to have a theme or a cause at its heart. It seems to be something else. And I wonder if he even knows what it is.
Yeah.
A strange business. There were definitely things in it that were quite nicely done. Like, you know, having worked and continuing to work in marketing, I felt very strongly pang for when she's out in that parking lot and trying to demonstrate the mop to everyone in the car park.
Oh yeah, and then she works out a way to she can be the ideal.
Oh yeah, yeah. You do the thing. You set it up, and you be the friend who takes interest in your product. Like, and that was a nice little moment. But man, like, it is hard, and that's what she was lacking, right? She didn't know how to market herself or get in front of people, and it was quite a nice way of showing that it's one thing to have an idea; it's an entirely other journey to get people to buy it and to be successful.
Yeah, those are the sort of moments that I wanted more of, those little scenes that were insightful to the journey that she's going through, rather than sort of illusions of weird character family quirks. But you liked that, didn't you? So
yeah, it was interesting. I preferred the first half of the movie. But there you go. I don't think there's much more to say. It's enjoyable, and you know, I'd be interested to know what other people thought. But I think it's going to get mixed reviews. I suspect some people will really like it. I was actually glad that it was funnier and the script was cleverer than I was expecting it to be, because some of those biopics can be a bit bleeding heart and everything's tremendous and a great breakthrough, whereas this felt quite chaotic and ramshackle, and actually it just happened to have a strong woman at its core. So yeah, I'll be interesting to know what others think.
Episode 9 is over.
No, I'm not finishing that song.
Oh, no, I thought it was good.
It was lovely.
That was completely impromptu as well. Impromptu?
Yes, it was. And that's why it was so very good, Phil.
I was really enjoying that.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, thanks very much for sticking with us and listening to episode number 9. Guys, we were number 1 in New and Noteworthy for TV and Film this week. What an achievement. We're very, very proud, and we're very thankful to everyone who's listening and hopefully enjoying the podcast. Thanks for the reviews. Thanks for the emails. Thanks for the downloads. Any thanks you want to give, Phil?
Just thanks for all the encouraging words we've received.
That's right, yeah.
It's been very nice. It's nice to have people listen and not think we're rubbish. So,
well, and we are enjoying it, and we're hoping to keep going. So, like I said, I think the Super Bailey Bros in Movie Land will become a fortnightly podcast, or to just give us more opportunities to watch stuff, to plan segments, and make it good every time a little new episode pops into your podcast list.
Yeah, exactly. We want to make sure our quality is great, and we keep producing fantastic Bailey Bros content.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it then, isn't it? So next week. Well, sorry, no, in 2 weeks' time, I guess, what will we be doing?
We'll be releasing another episode, and it's going to be great. I reckon we might go see either... There's 3 films we might go see. There's Hateful Eight, The Revenant, Leonardo DiCaprio film, or Creed, the one which you mentioned last week.
My vote's for Revenant.
I'd be interested in Revenant. It's the same director as the guy who did Birdman, last year's Oscar-winning best film.
That makes me
film.
less keen, although he's talented, but a bit nuts.
Well, so maybe we'll see one of those films. We'll make sure we try and see one of those films, and we'll hear what we think.
Have a lovely fortnight.
Bye, guys!
Bye.